What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting! From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to this week's episode of Intelligence Squared. And this week's episode was another event from our online subscription service, Intelligence Squared Plus. The topic was taming COVID and preventing the next pandemic. We were joined by two leading experts, Mark Honigsbaum, the medical historian and author of the new book, The Pandemic Century, A History of Global Contagion, from the Spanish Flu to COVID-19, as well as Sir David King, the former chief scientific advisor to the UK government and head of the Independent Sage Group, which is looking at how countries, and the UK specifically, should respond to the current pandemic. It was a really fascinating conversation, and it was chaired by senior investigative journalist at the Times newspaper, Manveen Rana, who is also the host of a terrific podcast called Stories of Our Times. And if you enjoy this episode, you should check out her podcast. There's a link in the podcast description, and there's a link for Mark Honigsbaum's great book there too. It's a fascinating conversation, and the event was part of our new subscription service, Intelligence Squared Plus. So you'll hear a lot of questions towards the end from our live audience. And if you enjoy it and you want to take part in some of our future events and ask your questions to the speakers, including our cancel culture debate coming up on the 22nd of September, you can go to intelligencesquared.com/plus and subscribe today with a special podcast discount code. Use the code podcast, PODCAST, at the checkout and join today to support Intelligence Squared and learn from some of the most brilliant minds. Now let's go to the episode.
Hello and welcome. I'd like to imagine everyone at home clapping at this point, but welcome to this Intelligence Squared Plus event with me, Manveen Rana, and I'm delighted to introduce an incredibly distinguished panel of guests. We're joined firstly by Mark Honigsbaum, who is a medical historian, journalist, and author of 5 books, including The Fever Trail, In Search of the Cure for Malaria, and most recently, The Pandemic Century, A History of Global Contagion from the Spanish Flu to COVID-19, which must be the most timely book published this year. He also hosts a podcast series, it's all the rage these days, entitled Going Viral, The Mother of All Pandemics. And his TED-Ed animation, How Pandemics Spread, has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. And just to assure you that when it comes to pandemics, we are properly covered. We're also joined by Sir David King, the former chief scientific advisor to the UK government from 2000 until 2007, and currently the chair of Independent Sage, which is a group of leading independent experts who are looking at how the UK should respond to the pandemic. David was previously the government's special representative for climate change from 2013 until 2017, and the founding director of the Smith School of Enterprise and Environment at Oxford. Mark, take us right back to the beginning. You've looked at pandemics before. What do we know about this particular one, and what distinguished it from things like SARS-1 or Ebola or swine flu, which had come along in the last few years? What made this one literally go so viral?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. Quite a difficult one to answer because there are so many unknowns still about where precisely this virus spilled over, almost certainly spilled over from bats to humans. Most likely places, southern Yunnan, close to the borders with Myanmar and Laos. You know, Wuhan was just the signal. That's just where the signal was picked up. So it was most likely spreading silently or without anyone really noticing as early as late November. So it basically had about 1.5 months before anyone knew that it was out there and posed a threat. And in that period, any number of people could have taken it from China overseas. Of course, this is all in retrospect. At the time, when the first reports emerged from China in early January, Chinese clinicians, people working in hospitals, when they saw patients presenting, they very quickly recognized that these symptoms were very similar to SARS. You know, so SARS-1, as it's called, which caused the epidemic in 2002-2003. But SARS-1 was different because as soon as people presented at hospital, they were already very, very ill. It was a very florid disease. You couldn't mistake the symptoms. And it almost certainly didn't have as many asymptomatic or people with very, you know, mild symptoms that weren't being recognized. So I think that's a big difference. I think that this virus probably has become such a big pandemic precisely because it was able to spread silently under the radar for so long without us picking up the signal.
David, what made it so different for you? Why do you think this particular one is the one that seems to have taken hold of the globe in a way that the others never did?
So what I first of all want to say is when I was chief scientific advisor, I produced a very detailed report, 2006, it was published. 350 experts from around the world contributed to the report on infectious diseases. And we included scientists from China and from Africa because we were fairly convinced that a pandemic of this kind was likely to arise in those two areas because there's a lot of contact between humans and wild animals. People without refrigerators buy live animals and only kill them when they want to eat them. And so we predicted, and we did a very careful bit of modeling on this, that if a viral infection of the kind that we have here was to emerge anywhere in the world, we even tried putting it emerging in a small village in Africa, within 3 months it would be in every country of the world. And the reason is very simple. We have got the most efficient way of moving a virus around the world, which is air travel. And people get on planes without any signs of the symptoms of the disease and only develop it when they've arrived at their destination. And so in this way, we predicted a pandemic of this kind would happen through a mutation, a chance mutation of a virus from an animal host to a human being, and that would be selected so that it was comfortable in the human host. And once that happened, it would be in the rest of the world within, as I say, 3 months. Nothing unexpected. We predicted this would happen before 2030, and here we are, 2020, and it's arrived.
Mark, when it did first arrive, there was a lot of talk, and there has been all the way through the pandemic, really, of comparing it to the Spanish flu. And I noticed that, you know, the title of your book obviously does talks of that too. Are there similarities, or would you compare this to another pandemic?
Well, I think certainly the Spanish flu is the closest comparator we have. Although, of course, there are many very, very important differences. And I think those differences are the things we got wrong, actually, because all the modelling from Imperial and other places was based on pandemic influenza, the assumption that the next pandemic would be caused by an influenza virus. So, yes, I mean, the similarities are obvious that they're both respiratory pathogens. They both spread easily through the air, you know, on respiratory droplets or as aerosols. Also, you know, through touching things that people have coughed on or sneezed on. So all these things are, you know, clear parallels. I mean, the other reason why 1918 leapt to mind is because the case fatality rate, the initial reports coming out of China, suggested it had a very similar case fatality rate to the Spanish flu, you know, in excess of 2%. You know, initial reports from China were as high as 6%. But they've now settled, the consensus is it's somewhere between, I think, 0.7 and 2%. The Spanish flu was probably 2 to 3%. But of course, the Spanish flu, we didn't have antibiotics, we didn't have ventilators, we didn't have high-tech medicine. All of those things might have brought that case fatality rate down considerably. And we were already seeing that, you know, in the United States, an astounding number of people, 185,000 Americans have died. Globally, we're very rapidly approaching the 1 million death mark. And it's, you know, it's likely to be much higher than that by the time this pandemic ends, whenever that might be. But I do think that we should also have looked to more recent epidemic pandemic outbreaks. So David has mentioned Ebola in West Africa in 2014. Of course, we had swine flu in 2009. I mean, it's important to remember that these pandemics don't always emerge, you know, in China or the East. You know, swine flu started in Mexico and Southern California. and spread rapidly worldwide. But yes, the key thing is that, you know, we're seeing more and more of these emergence events. And because of the pressures that global populations are putting on rainforests, air travel, but also an increased connectivity from roads and rail. So in 2017, a high-speed rail link was opened from Kunming to Wuhan. And that is probably the most likely way that a virus got all the way from Kunming to Wuhan. It wasn't a bat flying 1,000 kilometres. It was a person probably carrying the virus undetected.
It's interesting you say that, because obviously sort of with Ebola and SARS, we did see big, they were big pandemics, but they were sort of quite localised. They didn't travel as far. Is this what we can expect from the future? Will all viruses that pop up, will they be global?
Well, very quickly, I want David to answer that. I'm sure he's got opinions. But I mean, I think we were very lucky with SARS and with Ebola. If you remember, with Ebola, it took a massive military and humanitarian response where, you know, the armies of three nations, United States, France and Britain, mobilized massive resources to go to West Africa and suppress that virus and get it to zero. That was the mantra. Of course, you know, Ebola is very different. It's quite obvious when someone's ill with Ebola. And, you know, either they get very sick very rapidly and present at a hospital, or, you know, people run away and, you know, it doesn't spread much further, usually. So we've seen COVID's not like that. It's a sneaky, insidious foe. It spreads silently. And we're not always aware who's ill.
David, what do you think? Are we in line for a lot of global pandemics in the future? Is this just what the new normal will be?
I don't think there is a new normal. In other words, I think that Mark is quite right. There's a big difference between the Spanish flu, between SARS. These are all very different outbreaks. And I mean, what is very clear now is that this is a disease, COVID-19 is a disease that spreads very much through the air. It's an aerosol that if we're indoors, that is where most of the spread occurs. It's like 97% of the spread is occurring indoors. And that's simply because it hangs in the air and it can accumulate. You have to be exposed to this virus to quite a serious extent, at quite a high density, in order to suffer from the disease itself. And that is where you'll get it, indoors, if somebody else is breathing out the virus. Whereas if you're out of doors, you're relatively safe. Now, with SARS, in the SARS-1, that was a disease that was actually spread very largely in hospitals. It was spread by the virus was spreading in a moist atmosphere, and the moist atmosphere is what doctors were giving to patients to help them breathe. And so this is why the spread was largely in hospitals there. So each virus has different characteristics.
Naveen, could I make another very quick point about the difference between flu and COVID, which I think a lot of people still struggle to grasp? And it comes down to immunology, and I'm sure David could come in here. But what many people don't appreciate about influenza is when a new influenza pandemic virus emerges, there will be some people who have cross immunity, because usually those new pandemic viruses share lots of proteins in common with previous flus. So everyone's exposed to flu before the age of 2. That sets up their long-term memory cell response. So, for instance, in 1918, we think that no more than a quarter, maybe as much as no more than a third of the population, you know, was exposed to the virus and got the infection before it stopped. We don't think that's the case with COVID, because it's a completely new virus against which no one anywhere in the world has any immunity that we know about. I mean, there's lots of talk about this dark matter and possibly cross-immunity to other coronaviruses. But that is a very, very big difference. And it means that we really don't know when this pandemic will end without a vaccine.
I'm just taking you back to, as David said, all the preparations up until now for a pandemic had been, as you point out, for an influenza one, and the virus clearly came as a shock. But let's just go back to that moment when we realised that the pandemic had begun. I just want to look at the response that different countries had to that moment. So Italy was the first in Europe to impose a national lockdown, banning all non-essential movement on March the 10th. It was nearly 2 weeks later that Boris Johnson announced lockdown measures for the UK. That came on the 23rd. David, what did you make of Britain's response? You were part of planning for pandemic responses in the past. How do you think they handled it?
I was horrified. I quite simply felt as if the government had stepped back from the problem. They didn't understand, it seemed, the seriousness of the issue, the potential death rate, etc. I think the... Let me just go back to the countries that did operate exceptionally well. The first was China. China actually managed to keep this pandemic very largely in Wuhan. It didn't spread right across China, but they were the people who really invented lockdown. And they published on January the 23rd a remarkable paper which had the genetic makeup of the virus that enabled people to start around the world beginning to try to find a vaccine. So that paper, January 23rd, published in the British journal The Lancet, really gave an enormous amount of information to the rest of the world. People have been criticizing the Chinese. I wouldn't criticize them. I think they did an exceptional job. But secondly, what about South Korea? South Korea never went into lockdown. What the South Koreans did was have a test and trace policy, and that test and trace policy was functional. And I'm saying that because the British government has never produced a functional test and trace policy. So South Korea, much earlier than us, get exposed to the disease, and what they do is set up the test and trace so that most new cases are picked up immediately, and then everyone they've been in touch with over the previous 14 days is put into quarantine. So what they managed to do was to control the epidemic and keep the number of deaths down to a few hundred, compared with Britain at over 45,000. So where was the best behavior in Europe? Frankly, it wasn't Italy. It was Greece.
That's interesting.
Yep. What did the Greek government do? The WHO, in early February, put out advice for every country. Interestingly, our deputy... CMO, in one of the Prime Minister's briefings, she was standing on his right hand. And when she was asked, why didn't we take WHO advice? She said, that advice is for developing countries. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So basically, Greece followed every bit of the WHO advice. They didn't have the equipment in their hospitals to manage the pandemic, nor did we. But what did they do? In February, they were purchasing the equipment they needed in their hospitals in February. We didn't do a damn thing in February, right? So what you have is an exemplar country in Europe, Greece. Total number of deaths to date in Greece, less than 200. Compare that with our 45,000. Germany did quite well. They're still under 10,000 deaths. So I think the question has got to be, why does Britain behave worse than anywhere else in the world, if you look at it in terms of the number of fatalities per head of population, but also if you look at it in terms of the dramatic impact on our economy, where we're coming out worst in the world as well? And I have to say the two are completely related. If we had come in with a lockdown 1 week earlier, we would have had four times less deaths, and we would have come out of the pandemic far, far earlier, because it wouldn't have been right around the country.
So, David, you've planned for pandemic responses before. For you, was it the fact that you think lockdown came too late? Was that the most damaging thing, or were there other things that the government should have been doing?
Yes, I think what I'm saying is the government didn't do anything in February, let alone January, but let me take Greece as the example. They didn't have a test and trace system beyond early March. They were operating test and trace, and then it got beyond them and they stopped operating test and trace. They didn't improve the public test and trace system. They decided to set up a new company or two new companies, one to do the testing, one to do the tracing. And those two companies had no previous experience in public health. So what we had, the government is now very proud of the fact that they've set up these companies, these private companies. We could have, not one GP is doing the testing. isn't that where we would normally operate our testing? If I tell you there's now 1,400 new cases per day in the United Kingdom, that's a large number for a single company to operate centrally. But if you divide it out amongst all of our GPs, it becomes a small number, and they can handle it. So we have just handled it late, too late, and exceptionally badly. We're now here in August with a pandemic that began in February in Europe, and we still haven't got a test and trace system picking up the full range of people going down with the disease.
Mark, what did you make of the government's response?
Well, I mean, I echo most of what Sir David said there. I mean, I was tearing my hair out in late January. I think it's, you know, although the Chinese did mount a very aggressive response, there were critical 3 weeks early on where they weren't nearly transparent enough. And if you remember during those early days, there was a lot of confusion about precisely how many people were being hospitalised. And there was a mystery at one point of why aren't people being discharged if numbers are coming down. That's a separate issue. But certainly by the end of January, once the WHO had been able to visit China and they declared a public health emergency of an international concern, that should have been all the wake-up call Britain and other countries needed. And certainly when the weekend I saw the outbreak happening in Lombardy, you know, that's when I said to my mum, who's 88, mum, you're not going out to the theatre or on the bus anymore, okay? So, you know, this was just common sense to me. So what I couldn't believe is, you know, in these situations, you think, well, there must be other people, experts in government, who know all this and are thinking along these lines. But the more and more we saw of the sort of slow and behind the curve response, the more it became obvious that they really weren't. I think a lot of this comes down to the idea that I think affects this government, but maybe it's a British disease in general, the idea of exceptionalism, you know, that somehow we're different, we're better in Britain. We don't have to listen not just to other countries, but other scientists from other countries. And I think that was particularly true of the reluctance really to learn from the experience of countries and scientists in Southeast Asia and health professionals who had experience of containing SARS-1. You know, and we saw this debate go on endlessly, for instance, around face masks. You know, should you wear a face mask, shouldn't you? Well, you know, populations in Hong Kong and South Korea just adopted them because they knew that's what seemed to work during SARS-1. But I think that we will be having inquests about this for a very, very long time. I think there are multiple reasons, you know, 10 years of underfunding, you know, setting up PHE and centralising our laboratory services, you know, the distraction of Brexit. You could argue that we spent the last 3 years planning for the wrong crisis, right? So perhaps if we'd really planned for a pandemic and there were all sorts of pandemic exercises which identified all the things that came to pass, you know, not enough PPE, you know, all the things that we now know that we could have put in place before this event, we simply didn't do.
Can I come in on that just very quickly?
Yes.
David,
tell us what went wrong with your plans? You drew them up. Why weren't they working?
The plans that I produced back in 2006, you mean?
Yes.
Well, I think Mark's already referred to that. The big austerity measures introduced 2010, particularly 2012, the unwinding of the healthcare system, all of that left us in a very weak position, and we weren't able to cope with it. But now I'm going to say another thing, which is I believe the Prime Minister really believed that it was better not to go into lockdown because he felt that would be very damaging to our economy. And he actually made a speech in this period, I think it was about March the 12th or 15th, he made a speech saying, we will be like Superman stepping out of that post box, whatever it was, and flying off into the world, leading it on our economic growth, because we're not going into lockdown. And so we were told to put up with the deaths of our older relatives. I suspect I'm one of those older relatives. And he did say that on television. So I think there was an idea that we could manage this with herd immunity.
Well, look, Let me just put that to both of you, actually. I mean, what about the case of Sweden? Could they have got it right, after all? Because they've had about the same death rate. They didn't have to shut down their economy at any point. And there is a possibility, I know we don't understand enough about it at the moment, but there is a possibility that they might have something approaching herd immunity, if immunity really works in the way that we think it does. So Mark first, is Sweden a model we should think about emulating in future?
Well, I think there's a problem with looking at any country's death statistics and sort of extrapolating from them, applying them to other countries that are completely different. So, you know, Sweden yes. has a population, a much smaller population, of the order of 2 million, right? It doesn't have mega cities like London or Manchester with very diverse populations, completely different demographic. You really have to compare Sweden with other Nordic countries. And if you compare Sweden with other Nordic countries, it hasn't performed well at all. So, you know, its GDP has fallen by 8.6% in the second quarter. In comparison, Finland's is at just down 3.2%. And Denmark, which is just across the water from Sweden, is 7.4%. Sweden's death rate is more than five times Denmark's and more than 11 times Norway's and 10 times Finland's, right? So it hasn't done well either on containing deaths compared to its Nordic neighbours. And the economy isn't doing as well either. Of course, if you compare Sweden to Spain or Britain, then, you know, it does look like it's performing rather better. But we're performing so badly, that's why.
David, the Swedish example?
No, I agree with everything Mark has just said. The real issue is, does a government actually put up with, and I'm now talking about Britain, not Sweden, because it is very different in its demographics, does a country put up with a very large number of fatalities, even if those fatalities are only with the over 60-year-olds? You know, it's a real question of ethics, and it's a question also of managing communities. So let me just remind everybody that it is in the deprived areas of our cities that the epidemic is at its worst. And in those deprived areas, you find the highest percentage of BME community people, and that is the ethnic community that is suffering the worst. In those communities, you very often find multi-generations living in one house. And of course, if that happens and you've got children going off to school, coming home with the disease, they're not suffering, but they've got the virus, passing it on to great-grandmother, then great-grandmother is likely to suffer very badly. So all of these issues have to be taken into account.
David, on that question of how the pandemic is focused in certain pockets and deprivation, it doesn't help. We are now all thinking about the idea of a second wave. Do you think there's a chance that it might just be manifested in sort of localised lockdowns, as we're seeing already across the country, and we'll be able to handle it? What are you expecting?
Yes, I am expecting exactly that, and that is what we've got now. So if you're asking about a second wave, the number of infections today...
Is this it? Is this the second wave?
Yes, we're already beginning. It's a fairly soft second wave, but we are moving up in terms of the number of infections in the country quite substantially, and that is occurring very much in our cities and in the... For example, in Leicester, it's in East Leicester, which is the more deprived area of Leicester. So that is exactly what is going to happen. But of course, there's then a big question of, and how do we handle that? How do we handle that? And also see that we have some sort of justice in the handling. If we simply say schools in those areas will have to close down, I would say not enough. Now what do you do about the children that are deprived of education? These are often the children that don't have laptops and things at home where they can continue with their education. What we need to see is government stepping in and saying, how do we help those communities where the lockdown is going to continue?
And Mark, I mean, you've written about this, but with the Spanish flu, which is the one we keep comparing everything to, the second wave was worse than the first. What are you expecting this time round?
Well, I mean, I I expect and hope that it will sort of follow the pattern that, David has just described. But I mean, the big unknown, of course, and the reason why people do return to 1918 is that the first wave of the Spanish flu, which occurred in the late spring, early summer, so a little bit later than COVID, which started in January, but essentially the similar time of year, was quite mild. It was when the flu returned in the autumn, during the traditional season of colds and flus and respiratory diseases, that we saw the bulk of the mortality, and it was a very much more severe. But that's almost certainly because the virus mutated in the interim. There's no evidence, as far as I know, that this coronavirus is mutating. I mean, one of the things that where we've got lucky, actually, is it seems that when it did emerge from whichever animal host into humans, it was already quite well adapted to human transmission. So it hasn't mutated so as to become more virulent, okay, or less virulent, which is the other thing that could happen. But I mean, the big unknown is what is going to happen when it interacts with influenza and all the other things that circulate. So we already know that people with comorbidities or underlying health conditions are at heightened risk. And after all, every year in this country around late December, January, we see an absolute crush on A&E services with the elderly. And we barely cope then. So I really don't think we can be relaxed or confident that, you know, we're not going to see quite widespread and intense pressures on health services all over the country, and perhaps at the same time.
Can I just come in with an additional fact, which is, of course, in the winter, we spend much more time indoors. Mm. We tend to meet up indoors. Schooling is indoors. And this means, because we know this virus spreads indoors, that we are more likely to see the virus spreading. Everything depends on who you're with indoors. If you're in a pub, I would say this is a very, very dangerous place in terms of transmission. Equally in a restaurant. And of course, both of these are now open.
I was really hoping you weren't going to say that about the pubs.
I'm just reminded I spent quite a lot of time in the pub last night. I'm regretting
very depressingly. I want to ask you both what the question I imagine most people want to know, which is, how does this all end? Is there a vaccine in sight? I mean, David, do you think we'll get one soon?
There are a lot of laboratories attempting to produce a vaccine. They've been at it since that January 23rd paper was published. And we get a lot of hype about these vaccines. And I say hype because a vaccine isn't a vaccine until it's been all the way through all the tests. And the tests go through group one, group two, group three. And it really needs to go through phase three to completion before we can actually say we have a vaccine that will be safe and can be used in the public domain. I'll tell you what my biggest worry is right now. It is unlikely that, for example, let's take the Oxford vaccine, about which we know quite a lot because it's a British vaccine. If that was released into the public before it's been through the final third phase of testing, we may have a very bad outcome where a few people start dying as a result of having the vaccine. Now, for me, that's the worst possible outcome. All right, this epidemic is causing a lot of deaths. But my worry is nobody will trust vaccines again. Right? So it's more what will happen to MMR vaccines, what will happen to the standard vaccines that have saved so many millions of lives. So I'm really worried about the current pressure being put on by Putin, by the President of the United States, and by our Prime Minister to get these vaccines out quickly. I fully understand, but I'm really worried about that. We're still 6 months to 12 months away from a fully tested vaccine.
Mark, will we get in a vaccine? And if not, how else can the pandemic end? You know, you talked about Ebola. Is it possible to end a pandemic without a vaccine?
Yes. I mean, so very quickly on the vaccine, I mean, I agree there is a lot of hype over vaccines. We should you know, be cautious because on average it takes 5 to 10 years to develop a vaccine. I think in the last 30 years, we've actually only brought 5 new vaccines to market. So that should tell you how difficult it is. Of course, there's a massive investment going on. I think we're going to do better than that this time. And I definitely think we're going to have an emergency vaccine sometime next year that will be used or available to front row health responders. How do pandemics end? They usually end with a whimper, not a bang. OK, you know, I think the coronavirus is going to be with us for some time, even if we have a vaccine, for the reasons David King has alluded to. We saw demonstrations this weekend in Berlin and London from people who don't even believe the coronavirus is real. They think the whole thing's a hoax and they would certainly refuse to take a vaccine. Polling suggests as much as 30% of Americans fall into that category. So I think that's very worrying for anyone who's relying on a vaccine to end this pandemic. Yes, in West Africa with Ebola, we got infections transmissions to zero by chasing down all the contacts and all the contacts of the contacts. That's possible, but only if you get effective test and trace up and running. We don't have that yet. So, yep, it's possible, but we've got to do a lot of things that we're still not doing right.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
We're going to move to some of the questions coming in from the audience. And firstly, I want to ask you both, David first, is the second wave going to be exacerbated by going back to school?
A lot of people will be wondering this week.
That's a very important question, and Independent Sage has got a second report on going back to schools coming out this week. I think the answer is schools are preparing themselves as best they can to see that there is a separation of groups of students. Here's the problem. If one student is tested positive for the disease, one pupil is tested positive, the whole class are in contact with that person, and the whole class therefore have to go into isolation. So my question is going to be, how prevalent is that going to be in the situation where the number of infected people in the country is on the rise? It would have been far wiser if we had kept away, I'm afraid, Manveen, if we had kept pubs closed for another 3 weeks, if we had kept restaurants closed for another 3 weeks, if we had not lifted all of that and used the summer months to get rid of the disease, if we had headed towards zero COVID, we could open schools safely. Now, I don't know what's going to happen, but I seriously worry that there is going to be an increased number of people going down with the disease. But the good news is, and this is a real puzzle, the number of people dying is not going up. It's down to a very small number today. And that is the good news. The number of people going into hospital is also coming down. So we don't know really how it's all going to pan out at this point in time.
Mark, is it a good idea for people to go back to school now?
Well, I mean...
It's interesting, isn't it, how this pandemic doesn't seem to sort of affect children in the way that other pandemics have.
Yeah, look, I think you do have to distinguish. I think it is important that children go back to school, especially the younger age groups. You know, there isn't very much evidence that the young children are particularly at risk from severe disease, and they don't appear to spread it in the way that perhaps they spread influenza in the community. I think it's more of a question for the older cohorts, you know, 11 and upwards. You're speaking to someone who is right now preparing to go back and teach in a university environment. So obviously it's even more of a concern with, you know, teenagers and people in their early 20s. But I think that what would give everyone more reassurance is if we were able to do rapid virus testing at a local level when and where we need it. I mean, this is what's still missing. So I know that Sir David's been very focused on, you know, the threat of climate change. The reason I mention that is one of the central heroes of my book is a French researcher called René Dubos, who was the person who coined the phrase, think globally, act locally. Okay, what does that mean in the context of the pandemic? It means when you see an outbreak happening on the other side of the world, you don't think, oh, that will never happen here. You think that could happen here and you start to prepare for it. And the best way of responding to these things is to empower local communities and give them all the technological tools, laboratories, you know, medicines, you know, access to the best hospital care, and then mobilize teams of local contact tracers, people who know people in the community and can speak to them in terms they understand, and persuade them to do what's not only in their interest, but in the interest of their neighbours and their communities. That is what has been missing throughout this shambolic response from our government, I'm afraid.
David, before we sort of finish up on schools, there's another question that's come in I just sort of wanted to put to you. And this is about the idea that children, people who are shielding, and children who are shielding are now also going to be returning to schools, and children from families who are shielding will be returning to schools. And there does seem to be considerable research, as this question says. A recent study in the US and South Korea seems to indicate that many children are infected with COVID without any symptoms for a considerable period of time, so they're asymptomatic. Is that particularly dangerous? Are the people who should be shielding the ones we should be worrying about?
Yes. So I think the first thing is, let me just confirm what Mark said. This isn't a disease that is impacting on children as severely as it is on older people. It's really age-related in terms of the number of fatalities, but even in terms of the way the disease impacts on people. So very interestingly, even up to the age of 16 to 18, it is not impacting heavily. Very, very small number of people are getting very ill in that age range. However, people over the age of 11, 12 do become infectious. So even though they're not suffering at all, they become infectious and they can spread the virus as easily as an adult who has the disease. So this puts the carer at risk, the person back at home. Now, that is something that every single person who is being put into isolation because they are vulnerable puts them into a difficult position. They have to make that decision. I'm going to say, again, repeat what Mark said, so important that children get back to school. Being out of school for 4 or 5 months is just really challenging for most of our young people. So I'm all for schools opening. I'm all for kids going back. And everyone in that position really has to justify this in terms of infection rate in their local community. If the infection rate in your local community is low, then the chances of the child bringing the disease back is going to be very small, very small. So I think, you know, everyone has to make that judgment.
I wanted to ask, and there's a question in from the audience. It slightly places both of you on the spot, which is no bad thing. If it were February 2020 again, what one big major change or decision would each of you advise the government? So, David, first, you've done this before. What should the government have done? What would you have told them to do back in February?
Right. So quite simply, this is what I would have said back in February. So this isn't with hindsight. What I would have said is, when you were setting up for Brexit, preparing for Brexit, the government set up a department for Brexit. And that became a very big department in government. I would have set up a department for the pandemic, and I would have brought in some experienced individuals to run that department, by which I mean a previous minister, somebody who's held a job as a minister in government for some period of time and performed well. I would have brought in a very top-level permanent secretary to run that group. I would have brought in top civil servants, and I would have made sure that the chief scientific advisor was able to talk to the public about the disease and what was needed and what should happen. I'm saying that because when I introduced independent SAGE, I was illustrating what it ought to be like with a science advisor who was allowed to talk openly to the public and get public advice. We've been holding public meetings to get feedback from the public and changing our views on the basis of that. So I think it is really important to gain the public trust in this process. And we actually failed in that. So there's many, many things that I would have done.
Mark, I'm buying you another minute to work out your answer, because David, and there's another question which has come in, which is just saying quite simply, why aren't the government listening to your advice? You know, you've just talked about the process independent SAGE are going through. Why haven't they been listening?
Well, we can pick up instances where they have listened. So, for example, when we held our first public meeting and they hadn't yet published any of their minutes, they hadn't even told the public who was on their science advisory group. While we were holding the public meeting, they were all published. Secondly, we said going back to school should be a priority. At the beginning of the summer, we said this. The Prime Minister came out saying, going back to school is our priority. Great. The trouble is he didn't follow it up. Right? So what we said is use the summer to get the epidemic down to the lowest possible level. So why hasn't he followed our advice? What the government says every time people in the media ask the government, what the government replies is, oh, we're taking account of every bit of advice we're hearing. Okay, I don't know the real answer to that question.
Fair enough. Thank you for playing ball. Mark, what would you...
Well, I think very simply I would have said, don't only listen to the disease modellers. You need to listen to people with expertise in public health, okay? I think there was far too much looking at numbers and like fantasy scenarios and what if this happened. What we needed was real data. And that comes from mobilizing people on the ground And it's really striking. We looked at the makeup of SAGE, not independent SAGE, but, you know, the committee of government. There were no public health people there. You know, there were not enough people from other disciplines to encourage people to think out of the box and be alert to the unexpected. And that's the big lesson of all the pandemics and epidemics that I kind of survey in this book, is that, you know, we're always trapped by our knowledge of the one that went before. And we continually forget the sort of tried, tested lessons of how to respond to epidemics. And, you know, there are people who know this stuff and they work in public health. So listen to them.
Can I come in very briefly?
Of course.
All right. So just to say, absolutely, Mark is right. So if you look at the independent SAGE group, we have more public health experts than epidemiologists. We only have one epidemiologist. We have a virologist. But also, we are 50% female, 50% male, and we have a good representation from the BME community. So if you look at the composition of SAGE, you can see that it is designed to do exactly what Mark suggests.
And David, do you think they were guilty of groupthink? Is that something that went wrong with SAGE?
Yeah. Certainly.
No question.
Yeah.
No question. Yeah. I think this idea of herd immunity was an example of groupthink. But the other strange idea was that you've got dealing with the epidemic against dealing with the economy. Mm-hmm. The sooner you deal with the epidemic, the sooner you can open up your economy again. And we left it later than any other country before we went into lockdown.
Yeah. I mean, look, this all goes back to like modelling our response on the wrong pandemic, influenza, which, you know, the received wisdom was, well, once influenza said there's nothing we can do about it, so we just surrendered to the virus. Okay. And that worked until, you know, somebody saw the numbers being predicted by Neil Ferguson, the 500,000 people might die if we don't do something, and then all panic let loose, right? And we've just been lurching and panicking from one response to another without any real sort of long-term thought through, you know, considered plan. And you're right. I mean, these two things aren't in opposition. You know, the virus is here to stay and we want people to work and go to school at the same time.
Well, if you think our response has been bad, you're going to love this next question. We've got a question saying, how do you see the outlook for controlling the pandemic in the US compared to the UK?
Bad. Look, I think America has very different problems. You know, you both have federal and state. And so you can point to some governors. I mean, for instance, in New York, I mean, Cuomo did an outstanding job. I mean, there is a real pandemic war leader, right? A guy who gives you the unvarnished facts, tells you how things are and what needs to be done and, you know, doesn't gild the cherry. So we need more politicians like that, quite frankly. And, you know, he listened to the public health experts. So, you know, I think that although New York was hit really bad, they're probably in quite good shape for the second wave. Where, you know, we are less confident is in those states with Republican governors and people who are still denying, you know, facts that are staring them in the face.
And David, without wanting to keep plugging the Times, it did have a very interesting interview today with Dr. Anthony Fauci, who says he's gone from giving hourly updates to President Trump hasn't spoken to him for 10 days. He's not sort of taking calls, apparently. I mean, well, how do you see the outlook in America?
Well, just compare that with the Greek prime minister. So the Greek prime minister in late January or February went on television at 6 p.m. in the evening with his chief scientific advisor, and he explained, I'm handing this over to the science advisors, and they are going to tell me how to run this epidemic. 6 p.m. in the evening, every Greek citizen was watching television to learn what they were going to do. They were told 6 weeks in advance, the lockdown would end, and it ended on that day. Everything was planned, and it was put into the public domain by the scientists. There's the contrast.
And by the way, that's a much better strategy for a politician anyway, because, you know, they then don't have to take responsibility. And they can claim, if it turns out well, they can claim, well, you know, see, I was a good leader here.
Deflect
it's
blame.
It's a no-brainer.
To keep all of our audience in America happy, here's a question from Vermont. And it says, seriously, why has the general population become so antagonistic to measures advised to contain this vicious virus? Is it poor messaging? mass stupidity or something else? What's going wrong? Why are so many people convinced this virus shouldn't?
Because we no longer have, vertical top-down media. People get their information wherever they want and from whatever pseudo-experts they want to approach. So we have a massive problem with trust in science, but trust in expertise in general. And, people simply don't believe, I think it's particularly problematic where people see that even scientists disagree. But of course, scientists have always disagreed. There's no such thing as settled science. Science is always evolving and changing. That's what makes science so brilliant. You can change your opinion when new facts come along and you need a better paradigm. So I just think that there are a lot of people going out there and cherry picking information that they want to suit an ideological prejudice they already have in their minds. And, we can't rely on particular newspapers or broadcasters to deliver a message that will command consensus in the general population.
Can I come in on that one? Because I think I'm going to come back to Greece, where the Greek population are not the best behaved group of people around, right? Oh, no, we don't want to wear crash helmets. It's the European Union law. So you see Greek people riding around on motorbikes with a crash helmet on their arm. Stopped by the police, they start wearing a crash helmet. It's on my arm. The law doesn't say where you've got to wear it. So why did the Greeks all behave so well? They trusted the scientists, right? So because the scientists were explaining every detail in as much care as anyone wanted when they asked questions. Another example of good behavior, New Zealand, where the Prime Minister there herself is able to absorb the science that she's given. So I think an awful lot depends on the personality and the character of the head of government, because if the head of government pretends that he understands, you've lost the trust of the people. And I think our Prime Minister also lost the trust of the people because of some of the things he was doing. What about saying, wash your hands, and then he goes into a hospital and shakes hands with six people who have COVID-19. Now, that was not an illustration of him understanding the nature of this epidemic.
Well, we're running out of time, but there's just one quick question from the audience, which I desperately want to know the answer to. And also, David, you brought up New Zealand there. Do either of you have a comment on why countries with women as heads of government have done so much better?
Well, I think it's certainly, we've already heard about her in New Zealand, but I mean, in the case of Germany, Angela Merkel has done pretty well too. And I have to say, she studied science. She trained as a science, We actually, I'm not only a great supporter of the Conservative Party, but I think Margaret Thatcher also demonstrated a leadership on, when we had a problem with the ozone layer, because she understood science. So I think it matters tremendously in public life, that politicians are educated and, can translate quite complicated scientific ideas into public policy.
But it's not only women. So I'm going to actually give you an example of Tony Blair. During the foot and mouth disease epidemic, he was really in a quandary because it was just taking off. It looked as if we were going to cull 50% of our livestock to get it under control. And I came to him with a group of people who had an alternative to the way it was being handled in the government. And he didn't even go on television. He simply said, right, you are taking over, right? I was on television every day. The head of the civil service, and this goes back to an earlier point Mark made, actually said to me, you do realize that you are now in the firing line. Now, I understand that, but the whole point is that I think I developed the trust of the public in a way that the Prime Minister couldn't, and he understood that.
Well, I'm afraid we've just run out of time, which is such a pity. We could have done this for much longer. But thank you both. Thank you, Mark Honigsbaum. Thank you, Sir David King. Thank you for everyone who's been sending in questions and tuning in wherever you are. And thank you to Intelligence Squared for hosting us.